Paul, Sean. It's so great to be here. I'm Simon, and I've been living and breathing data for a couple of decades now. So yeah, great to have an opportunity to chat with you both today.
Welcome to Keeping Up With Data. Keeping Up With Data is the podcast that keeps data enthusiasts up to speed with what is happening in the data world. We bring in the leading minds from the data industry to talk all things career, news, embarrassing stories, failures, and successes.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to this one. I think I've been trying to get Simon on the podcast for a very long time. Very hard man to guess, man about town. So we will delve into a lot of different topics, scenarios. I think the main things we're going to run through, Simon obviously has wrote a book recently, published. So we want to delve into that for anybody who'd be interested in understanding how he went about it, publications, challenges, everything to do with the book. Consulting, Simon's been a man about consulting for a very long period of time, built high-performing teams. We want to understand the different dynamics, struggles, address some of the stigma within, and just have a general flow. So I suppose, Simon, we'll start with how you got into data all those decades ago. It's evolved probably into something that you would have never, ever imagined all those years ago to what it is now. Fill us in on how you got in and kind of...
I would love to tell you about the amazing plan and the life trajectory I had and the sequence of steps I followed with a great precision and plan. But no, honestly, it was a bunch of random things. So I think maybe this might be a recurring theme as we talk about life in the data space. But yeah, really, I fell into data engineering, I'm going to say, 20 years or so ago. I left university, I joined a software consulting firm, and by just happenstance, I ended up on a very data-heavy project. It was one of the first client engagements I had, and I loved it. I loved this idea around working with data, modeling real-world systems, and I think from there, I just sort of had this appreciation of working with data and having this sort of cool moment of realization that you can do things in data to represent things in the real world. And they both interact with one another. And it really became sort of this fascinating thread throughout my career to just play with data and do cool things.
Yeah. Absolutely. I think when I first started experiencing the word data was when obviously I started in recruitment and I was like, oh, this is so cool. It's all just starting now. No, it hasn't. It's been around for years and years, decades. So I think your trajectory from, let's say, 2000 onwards has been like a total change. What was it like back then from a data engineering space, shall we say, to what it is now?
Yes, yeah, and it's a good question. And sometimes I have to almost pinch myself the moment when I almost like conceptualizing how to solve problems, because we have much better ways of solving what used to be really hard problems. I would say that my career spans even before the time of data engineering, where I would actually once upon a time describe myself as a database administrator.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah. You might eject me from the room about now, but that used to be a profession. It used to actually be a consideration that you actually needed to worry about, you know, the size of data stored on disk and how quickly you were going to access it. Mm-hmm. And these were like, you know, you would spend hours actually worrying about indexes on tables because, you know, the speed of accessing data used to be like a job and a career and a consideration. And mm-hmm. Now it's like, no one bothers about that, or at least you have much better ways of solving these problems using, you know, cloud or just better opinionated frameworks. So that was a long way of saying that, you know, a good sort of 15, 20 years or so ago, I used to care about some fairly low-level details. Mm-hmm. And now when I'm building data solutions and streaming pipelines and data experiences, I care much more around, you know, is this useful? Is this accessible? Is it going to bring something useful to a client or a customer quite quickly? So I still worry about how I'm going to bring that data to life, but the tools and techniques are just so much better and so much more formulated these days.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I think I may have lied when I said when I got in 2015, I first heard of data, but my uncle used to be a mainframe developer back in the day, and he told me he used to have to punch the code in. I don't know what it was, whether it was a typewriter or whatever it was, but he had to put all the code into a machine and manually do X, Y, and Z. But I do remember the DBA day, as not obviously from myself, but as a recruiter. And I think DBA has gone spread across data warehouse development, data engineering, analytics engineers and new terms. All of these new terms keep coming out, and that's it's right. Where is it going to evolve to? If I was to ask one question, I suppose, for maybe the newer age engineers as such, what would you say the main changes, maybe by the speed and all the technology, but how databases were developed back then, the DBA kind of methodology versus now?
Yeah, I think a lot of the considerations are there, but they're essentially someone else's problem. So once upon a time, I might have to worry about storage and provisioning, I/O and CPU and network interconnects. But I think most people these days are now using cloud native modern data solutions, and they are still problems, but essentially they're someone else's problems. So I think those considerations have sort of been consolidated down, and the hyperscalers are now taking care of a lot of the interconnects or the buying of servers or the provisioning of storage. And that means that although those things are important, they might not be my problem. And because they're not my problem, I can then focus on much more important things. Yeah. If I'm thinking about, you know, I'm working with a client, they're not going to be very happy if I tell them it's going to take hours, days, or weeks to go sort out storage. I don't think anyone's got tolerance for that anymore. Yeah. But it does mean that I do get to spend more time thinking about useful things. And I think, you know, talking to some of my more recent mentees or folks who are a bit more new to the industry, I think they've got just much more headroom to play with. They don't actually have to worry about some of these, what I'm going to just clarify as old school concerns. And I think that's sort of super liberating because they can focus on better problems rather than low-level problems.
I think that ties into the tech piece as well. So obviously we'll get into consulting and the high-performing teams. But I think right now in the industry, there's so much tech that's coming out. Everybody wants to have the newest, shiniest, greatest tool, migrate from this to this. What's your whole take on that? Because there's so much legacy tech death, and there's just death coming out of people's ears at this stage with new Databricks, Azure, Fabric. We want to do this. What's your whole taking a step outside the box and looking at it from a like business value perspective? Forget about the tools. Like, there's a lot more that can be done than just, I want to use database.
Yeah,
I want to use Python. Or...
And I think that's actually that is the question to talk about. And that's the challenge as technologists. We actually should be all asking ourselves is, are we solving something useful? No one asks for a database. They ask for an outcome. No one wants to build a data pipeline in isolation. They want to build a data experience. So one of the sort of the challenges, and I always have to ask that of myself and of my team, because rightfully so, we have to answer, why are we doing this? Are we doing this for an outcome? No one should be coming to work purely to build a data pipeline. Mm-hmm. We should be there to, you know, do audience segmentation, do an upsell, have faster payments networks. There's a reason for our efforts. So that's sort of a challenge that I think we should always be asking ourselves is like, when I'm considering a technology, is it a good use of our time to be worrying about this decision? If we've got a relational database over there, is it sufficient? Is it going to work for us? Or am I legitimately going to do, you know, a sprint or a spike to contemplate spinning up a new bit of tech? Sometimes it's good to anticipate, you know, is this going to go solve a good problem? But sometimes we have to ask ourselves, are we just doing it for fun and just playing with tech for no particular good reason?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like relational databases versus the new age warehouse.
Yeah.
In theory, do you think they can still run?
There's that wonderful, I'm going to butcher this, but there's this wonderful blog post of something along the lines of, why can't you just use Postgres? And it's this wonderful sort of tongue-in-cheek approach, but it actually does speak to a genuine truth of, you know, there's good old-fashioned relational databases. Yeah. They're tried, they're tested, they're battle-tested, all the rough edges have been sanded out. Mm-hmm. You can do an awful lot with classic database technologies. So if you're in a cloud, you know, every cloud provider offers a very, very well-regarded RDBMS endpoint, you can just use it. If you work for a bank, maybe you've got to use some on-premise technology. Mm-hmm. Good old-fashioned databases can solve an awful lot of problems. I'm not going to say that they solve every problem, but they shouldn't be just disregarded just because they're old-fashioned. I think we could actually say they're the Toyota Camry. They're about as reliable as ever.
Absolutely. I suppose on that note, is that as a common mistake or common trend that you see with some of the things that you've worked on where people overcomplicate simple things, right? Like they go overboard or they expect too much when realistically you can deliver with simple stuff?
I'd say yes, but.
Yeah.
Yes, sometimes folks focusing on, well, could we use this database over that database? Mm. And I think that can be a good question or a good thought process to go down. But I think we always have to sort of compensate against the, well, if we're having that debate, it means that we're not doing something else. Mm. And I think, you know, in that sort of language around agile delivery, it's much better to just deliver something and then iterate.
Yeah.
Maybe it's not the most perfect, you know, or ideal relational database choice. Maybe there is a 10% uplift that you could have using product X over product Y. Mm-hmm. But get a product at the door and then iterate. Having this idea around, with, you know, that classic, you know, is it a one-way or a two-way door decision?
Mm.
If you can make the choice later, you know, stick with something, build it now, get out there, prove, have a proof point, and then iterate later. So, yeah, it's a great question, but I do like the idea of, like, moving quickly.
Moving quickly, absolutely.
Yeah. That probably ties into the team dynamic. So, obviously, we wanted to touch on that around consulting. First thing I want to address will be the stigma around consulting.
Yes.
Mm.
Maybe you mightn't hear it as much as we hear it, but I'm always advising people. It's like, if you're junior, get into consulting because you can grow not just your business skills, but you can test if you want data science, AI, especially now. Sorry, I said that. be it whatever it may be within that space that you are thinking, technology is so big now, there's 101 different things you can focus on, and that there is a great route in.
Oh, 100%. It might be one of these sort of depth versus breadth kind of conversations. There's no right, there's no wrong, but there's definitely trade-offs. I was so fortunate to have moved into consulting early in my career because it gave me just this like great opportunity to get exposure to different technology, different people, different countries, different business verticals. And I look back on that time and just go, wow, it was just like such a roller coaster. I knew nothing, but it was very much about get challenged, get thrown onto a client side, get exposed to something, learn very, very quickly, maybe do it for 6 months, 9 months, 12 months, and then get exposed to another bunch of challenges. And as a learning experience, as a forcing function on, you know, being challenged, I couldn't ask for anything better. So 100% I'd agree with you. If you can, and, you know, it works to your, you know, living slightly on the edge, not of terror, but of maybe being challenged. Consulting is absolutely a great way to learn and learn quickly.
Absolutely. I think just on that note, Simon, I suppose it's always one of the key things that we look for in these podcasts is just general advice on that consulting piece. If you're speaking to someone who's junior, who's looking to get into data engineering, are there any sort of key traits that you look for in people or things that are going to make them successful in that space?
It's a good question. Maybe not so much traits. It's more sort of do people have essentially a bit of a willingness to just be a little bit uncomfortable?
Mm-hmm.
And I think anyone in IT should feel always challenged. If they're not feeling challenged, they might actually want to rethink their industry choice.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, as long as someone has a bit of aptitude to, you know, or tolerance to learning and being challenged, I think people would close the door a bit too quickly on the idea of being consultants. They think that they need to wear a special hat or a special badge or have a special background, but I wasn't a consultant to begin with.
Yeah.
I loved being a consultant.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good question, but yeah, it's trade-offs at the end of the day.
Yeah, I agree. I think a lot of people as well are almost too focused on the end goal in comparison. It's like, oh, like there's Simon, he's done a book, like he's, they don't see what the hard yards you've got through at the start. It's like the grass isn't always green on the other side.
There were
water it.
Many mistakes on the way. Numerous mistakes on the way. So, yeah, it's the never compare your innards to someone's external. Because obviously people should be rightfully proud of what they deliver, their successes in their career, things that they've produced in the real world. But, yeah, I'll be the first to say I've made numerous mistakes. Constantly making mistakes.
Yeah.
And I very much plan to make mistakes in the future. It's the only way anyone learns.
Yeah. I think rightly so, like, not name bashing anybody at all, but I think some businesses in a sense promise the sun, moon and stars for specifics and then word travel and now the social media and people can talk so much. So rightly so, some companies don't have the best of experiences for the consultants that come in, but there's a whole lot of other businesses that have amazing ones. So it's like, who you know refer yourself to those people, speak to them, ask what their experience in those businesses were like, and understand what the consultant life is for. But I'm an advocate for it for juniors, and it gives them such depth in their career moving forward. And I suppose that probably leads us on to the next question around forming those teams, because you've worked on some huge projects, like massive projects, different industries, as a leader of projects and having to build out those teams. What is your, it's quite sporadic, obviously, from what I'm thinking and visualizing inside, but I don't have your lens of experience. You're tasked with this huge projects, hypotheticals, like whatever it may be, a freight industry or whatever it is. You've got this huge project you need to do, projects come in, landed. Like, how do you start with that team dynamic of building that out?
It's a good question. So maybe just to frame this, I've had the opportunity to work with teams that are like, you know, myself or teams of one or two people. And I've worked on enormous projects where there are literally 2,000 engineers. And there's just a huge spectrum of trade-offs in between. Those sort of meaty size projects where you're measuring your team amongst other teams and you're measuring the number of engineers in the hundreds, they're challenging because you end up with a lot of almost like competing domains, and just sort of almost getting your head around, well, where do I sit within that sort of broader ecosystem? What's my relationship to this team? What's my relationship to other teams? Just having that sort of initial stakeholder map is super important. It's very, very easy to fall into this sort of natural well of, I'm just going to work inwardly with my own team. I see them every day. We have stand-ups together. I think there's a natural tendency to sort of ignore all the externals. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a bit of a trap. I think the finding what other teams are doing, the challenges, the opportunities. Mm-hmm. If you're working in a parallel way, if someone else has solved a problem or got a bit of insight on how to move forward, absolutely. You're only going to find that sort of that magic formula by talking to people. I think the one of the learnings I had from moving to very small teams to very, very large teams is the importance of communication, mm-hmm. clarity, both sharing what you're doing, both in a positive sense, but also sharing some of the friction and pain points. Because it turns out when you're working in a team alongside other big teams, they've also got problems and pain points. And yeah. one of the best coffee conversations you can have is discovering that you've got a problem that I can solve.
Yeah,
I've got a problem that you can solve.
Yeah.
Turns out that's the best kind of coffee conversation you can possibly have.
Problem shared is a problem, huh?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
That's really,
yeah. I mean, I suppose we should probably get into sort of the meaty part of this podcast, and that's this book, Getting Started with DuckDB. To use it.
Looking?
Yes.
Yeah.
Size copy from Simon?
Limited edition. So look, let's just start with the inspiration, why you started this sort of venture. I mean, it's not easy to start writing a book. So yeah, I just want to hear the origin.
Yes. Yeah. So maybe just a couple of steps back and as a bit of an orientation, because I'm sad to say not everyone in the world is living and breathing DuckDB at the moment. So just as a sort of a bit of an orientation, DuckDB, it's an open source bit of technology. I think if you looked at the project page, it would say something along the lines of, you know, it's an in-process SQL compatible analytics database engine, which is both technically correct and probably not very helpful. So one of the reasons I fell into sort of appreciation of DuckDB was it was solving some genuine problems I had in my professional day job. I found that quite often I needed something sort of lightweight. I needed something that was running on my own laptop. And this idea around something that was essentially the SQLite of analytics works really, really well for me. So if you were to just do a bit of character picking here, it's kind of like SQLite. It's a very, very small executable that you can download. Critical workloads, much like a Databricks, a Redshift, or a Snowflake. And the price point is very compelling because it's free. And it doesn't matter if you speak SQL or R or Python. It sort of integrates really nicely with all those ecosystems. So
wow.
I sort of felt just meandered my way into using DuckDB object stores or Hadoop stores and do stuff in R and stuff in Python. And cool, I was using for everything. That's kind of like how I meandered into this as an ecosystem. And just, so I was writing sort of blog posts and interacting with the community. And a publisher reached out and said, you're passionate about this.
Is it anything to do with MongoDB? Stupid question.
No.
DB and
only the ecosystem of another database.
Yeah.
So you could think of it as another database, but that almost like diminishes the utility of it. And I think one of the things I really need to credit is I wrote half of the book. The other half of this book was written by a good colleague of mine, Ned Letcher, who would describe himself more of a data scientist and data analyst. And I was actually working alongside Ned, and we kind of both realized we were using the same tool for different reasons. And then we had this sort of light bulb moment of going, we are using something that is loved by a data engineer and loved by a data scientist. And there's not many tools that sort of fill this sort of happy overlap. So the fact that we were both using the same tooling for various challenging use cases, and essentially we're both identifying this as a sort of a commonality for different personas in the data space, just became this sort of light bulb moment of there's something special here. Folks can use a tool that's very, very accessible and use it in various ways. It's something that's sort of should be installed in every data scientist. Or
when was the light bulb moment that you were like,
yeah,
let's make this happen?
Yeah, it was probably a good couple of years ago. So 2023, I had the first conversation with a publisher, and they were very helpful. And maybe as a bit of guidance, if anyone ever thinks that they want to write a book, by all means, sort of go down that path, but just be aware, it is so much work. It is an unbelievable amount of work.
Yeah.
And I think whatever lessons I had was, I think my idea of just sitting and writing a few things, sending it off to a publisher, and they click in print and book turns up, I think I was woefully misdirected on that. And one of the great learnings I had was it's important to get feedback. You have to take on that feedback, and you're not writing this necessarily for yourself. You're writing it for an external community. So it was a really, really solid process. But those feedback side was very brutal.
It actually reminded me just there of what you said. So my grandfather, rest in peace now, he died 2 years ago. He wrote a book when he was 90 years of age, not physically, obviously communicating it and people taking it down. And then his wife, who's still around, I can remember going up to her house and she had like folders upon folders upon folders. She's now released a book as well at 93 years of age of short stories of her life and like what Ireland was like growing up. But I can relate totally to that because her house was like an absolute bombshell of
incredible
everything and anything.
Yeah, there's a book in everyone. We'll ask you later what your...
Oh, God. I don't know.
You think we get a book?
God. Well, given the description you've just given me, like, I'm not too sure if I want to go through that process. Maybe in the future, who knows? But it's certainly a respectable task, right? Because it is a lot of your own personal time that you have to invest into doing something like this. So, yeah, I just wanted to understand the process, but you described that really well. Congrats, I suppose, and fingers crossed all goes well. I'm curious to know about the content within the book, like the general structure. What do you go through? What can people expect to learn from this?
Yeah, so we kind of, because I authored this with Ned, we did actually want to be quite clear on who we were writing this for. So we did actually write this down, write a very, very descriptive bit of internal language so we could actually be very, very clear with we are writing this for an engineer, we're writing this for an analyst, we're writing this for a data scientist, because we wanted to make sure there was like a through line and a level of consistency, and hopefully no one will ever work out who wrote which chapter because we were very, very consistent in who we were writing this for. So we wrote that down so we could anchor ourselves in consistency. And that also helped us then sort of structure the book. We wanted to structure the book around use cases and personas. We didn't want this to read like a database manual. We didn't want this to read like a Polar's data science workbook because no one would read that. We did want to make this very much action orientated so people could like pick it up from any chapter and think, I have a use case to solve. My use case might be, I have shed loads of data sitting in an object store and it's of an unknown schema and someone's asking for analysis on it. How would I go about that? Other people might say, I want to do this sort of exploratory data analysis. on some language text. How would I go about it? So we kind of tried to write this very much of a what I want in a book, which is here is a bootstrap mechanism for these kind of problems. Mm-hmm. I just want to get my job done. I want to be held and sort of directed on best practice, but I don't want too much fluff, and I want my problems to be solved quickly.
That was the next word about a sound, but I was like, it's taking the fluff out. Yeah, but, and this is what you need to do to get this result.
Yes.
This is cool.
That's amazing. I suppose more broadly, you know, when you look at, you know, writing future books, is this something you enjoy doing? Are you doing more? I don't know.
He's got five in the works.
I think I might describe this a bit like running a marathon. Mm. Like, it's great to say that you're a marathon runner. It doesn't matter if you've run one marathon or run several marathons. I've run one marathon, so I'm going to say that's enough. I've now read one book, so I can call myself. Written one book, so I can now call myself an author, and I think that might be sufficient.
Good answer,
Who knows?
Yeah.
Whatever may happen, you might think, well, interesting topic, it might just come naturally now that you've done it. I suppose with all of that, for me, I've never heard of DuckDB until I met you and heard of your book.
And bought the book. Yeah, correct.
Explain it in layman's terms, if my 93-year-old grandmother was listening to it, for example.
I would say it is the tool to get your data problems solved when you want to bring the compute to the data. So it's sometimes described as the SQLite for analytics workloads. And I like that description. It just means that it's very, very concise. It's very, very sort of toolkit orientated. And it allows you to just, you know, take the power of your laptop, which is sitting there idle most of the time, and just doing an incredible amount of work very, very quickly. But I also like the show rather than tell approach. Yeah. So one of the coolest demos you can do is just literally from your web browser, because it can actually run within your web browser, you can point it at, you know, New York taxi data set, say select star from average trip length, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
It will suck through 70 gigabytes of data in seconds and give you an answer. And you can go, wow, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
You didn't have to install anything or pay anyone money.
Oh, my goodness. That's amazing. I'm actually surprised that this is the first and I'm hearing of it personally. I think Sean as well.
Yeah, I recognize a lot of the things within.
Yeah. But this is super interesting, Simon. I suppose, well, firstly, where can people buy this book, by the way?
Oh, great question. So you can buy it, basically Amazon is probably your best go-to.
Yeah.
There's online portals where you can just essentially rent it month by month through, I think, Pact has a, and O'Reilly also have a way of accessing it. But yeah, if you're Sydney-based and you buy a physical copy, I'll even sign it for you.
Ah, perfect. How good.
I think the obviously you're a big man in events as well. Like networking, you host a lot of events. You've seen a lot of these things transpire from like data engineering bites tiny.
Yes.
Call it global now?
Oh, I'm going to say I am small cog in a large community event. So Peter Hannes does most of the work for data engineering bites, but it's a fantastic community of data engineers, Brisbane, Sydney, Melbourne, Perth, Wellington, Auckland. So I think we can now tick the box on international.
Mm.
And it's just fantastic to just see what is essentially not a vendor-led community come together, who are just essentially a whole bunch of data practitioners coming together. And it's terrific. We've had some amazing events at the tail end of 2024 where we literally had thousands of data engineers come together in our major cities, both here and in New Zealand. And to be just a small sort of catalyst amongst great speakers, great content writers, great volunteers who came together. It's just amazing to see the community come together.
I think if Peter's listening to this, Peter, I have tried to get you on the podcast probably 3 years at this stage. So maybe you can see what this one's all about. And if you're interested, we could elaborate a lot more into data engineering bites. But I think we're probably coming towards a natural end of the podcast, Simon. And what I'd like to ask as a final question, what has been the most surprising thing for you? Well, two questions. One, what has been the most surprising thing for you looking back when you started your career as to where data is now? And secondly would be, if you were to give that person walking into the first job advice on how to be a great engineer, or just general advice, if you were to look back at yourself as that kid walking in,
yes,
what would you say to yourself?
Maybe I don't think I have a super catchy thing, but I just sort of give you sort of like almost like heartfelt feelings around.
I don't mean to throw you on the back, but
And maybe my children are going to disagree with this. I think data has gone from something that used to be something in a server room to something that everyone actually understands and can sort of have a tangible sense about what it is. I would guess that if I went to a pub and mentioned data 15 or 20 years ago, folks would just go,
get out.
But I reckon I could walk down to a pub here and now mention data, and people will have an opinion about it.
Yeah.
They will see the value of it. They'll see the risks of it. They'll see the opportunities of it, and they'll see the downsides of it. So we are talking about something that is now cross-cutting across everyone's life, both for good and for bad. And I think that's very, very powerful to think about, well, we can help shape this. We can help marshal it. We can help bring value to it. And I think from essentially technology that used to be sort of hidden in a server room to something that's actually cross-cutting in people's lives is super useful. That's sort of just a long way of answering a very short question.
No, it's very good because it's so true. Like I've
2012,
I would have zero interest in the world of anything to do with it. And now I'm like, I live, breathe, and want to absolutely know absolutely everything about it. So I do find it so interesting. And then maybe that guy starting off career.
Yes.
What would you give?
If I could give younger Simon some advice, it would be, of course, buy Apple stock. buy some Bitcoin. Don't lose the password to your Bitcoin. But just more general advice is just say yes. Say yes to opportunities. Say yes to being slightly challenged. I think if I could give this career advice to my former self or to anyone joining the industry, just be a little more open to opportunities. Some opportunities are not so good, but many opportunities are. So just saying yes to new opportunities, it's amazing what doors get opened that way.
Absolutely. Well, it's been fantastic having you on, Simon. From my experience of meeting you today, it's been really insightful. I know Sean's our BI and data engineering guy here, but yeah, just getting the insight on getting started with DuckDB and what it means to just general coders who want to simplify their lives for free as well. How good is that? It's been great. So, thanks for your time, I suppose. Yeah.
I expect you to read this now and give Simon the...
I'll buy it right now. It's actually in my cart as we speak. So.
Good job.
Yeah.
These are the words I wanted to hear, Paul.
All righty, guys. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in.
See ya.
And that's that.
Yeah.
Bless you. We'll be right back.